So we have one more night of Hanukkah. We have the rest of today and tomorrow as the holiday leaves us. Our last chance to get in our final donuts while there's still while still Hanukkah and latkes and gelat and everything else. So I want to share one final message of Hanukkah we can take with us the rest of the year. We know that the Torah teaches us this world runs by Hashem's will. Hashem guides the world. Hashem guides events. And when you see major historic events, such as the miracles of Hanukkah, we have to know that there's a root cause to these events. Not only was it a historic event that was a decision of the Greek army to invade Israel and persecute the Jews, there is a deeper spiritual root, a spiritual cause to such events as well. If the Jewish people are attacked, we have to know not only did the nation who attacked us choose to attack us, but there's some underlying cause which God allowed them to attack us. That there's something we had done wrong. There's some sin, there's some root cause which caused the event, that brought it upon us. Because whenever there's a major event in Jewish history, it's not only a physical battle, it's a spiritual battle. Because God runs the world and God guides our destiny. So when something happens to us, there's some spiritual underpinnings to the event. So let's try to understand a little bit of the spiritual underpinnings to Hanukkah. We discussed a little bit about the clash of Greek culture versus Jewish culture last week, the Torah knowledge versus Greek knowledge. But today I want to look more not at the clash of cultures, but at what is it that the rabbis point to as the cause of why we brought upon ourselves such a tragedy. And essentially, when you discuss what brings about a catastrophe in Jewish history, a war, a battle, a struggle, it also helps understand what is the teshuvah to do. How do we rectify the situation? If God brought upon Jewish people a catastrophe for reason X, that means that we're supposed to somehow fix and perfect or rectify that problem so that God saves us. So the Hanukkah story as well, there was some underlying spiritual cause. There was an attack, there was a struggle, a persecution. And in the victory, we must find some sort of repair or rectification to the problem. So let's understand what was happening there. So I want to quote to you from a famous commentary known as the Bach, on the Bayis Chadash, one of the commentaries on the Torah Shulchan Aruch, written by Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, a great Jewish thinker. And he quotes in his work from Rabbi Meir of Rotenburg, who was also another famous early Jewish thinker. And he describes the contrast of Purim and Hanukkah. Purim and Hanukkah, as we know, are the two rabbinic holidays we observe. Other holidays are Torah-sourced, the Purim and Hanukkah rabbinic holidays. And often you find commentaries kind of comparing and contrasting Purim and Hanukkah, because the rabbis only established two holidays, and they chose to establish these two holidays. So how we understand them? So the Bach writes that Purim, the sin which the Jews were blamed for was a very physical sin. What were they blamed for? They were blamed, the Talmud says this, that they went to Ahasuerus' big party that he made. And it was a party that they should not have attended. It was a party celebrating the downfall of the Jewish people, destruction of the temple. It was a party where a lot of lewd behaviors were occurring. And the Jews should not have attended that party. Yet the Jews attended that party. They enjoyed and benefited from the party of Ahasuerus. Therefore, that was the underlying spiritual cause as to why Haman was able to decree to annihilate us, because we deserve annihilation from benefiting from that party. That's what the rabbis say. So when we were saved in the story of Purim, what happened? Queen Esther tells all the Jews, you need to fast for 3 days and three nights, don't eat, don't drink. And because we had sinned with our physical bodies, because we had enjoyed this lavish meal and feast of Ahasuerus, so we had to repent through physical bodies as well. We fasted, which is a physical form of repentance. Obviously, you need the heart involved as well, but the main action we find in terms of the Jews' repentance was physical. They fasted. So when the rabbis established Purim as a holiday, Purim is a day where we very much enjoy ourselves physically. It's a holiday of celebrating, of singing, of dancing, of eating, of drinking. That's the holiday of Purim. So he then describes Hanukkah. What was the spiritual roots of Hanukkah? Why was Hanukkah? What caused the challenge of Hanukkah, the struggle of Hanukkah, the battle of Hanukkah? Assimilation. Well, that's what we would think, and that's part of it. But he says something else here, which is interesting. The Bach writes, and it all goes together with assimilation. The Bach writes that we have become very lax in our service of God. A little lazy, a little lax, and lackadaisical in serving God. Because we became lax in serving God, because we became lax in serving God, lazy about our performance of mitzvot, our study of Torah, so that when the Greeks came in and attacked the land of Israel and made their decrees, the decrees were against the mitzvahs, particularly against the service in the temple, against the daily sacrifice, daily offering, the Karban Tamid. They defiled all the oils, as we know, so we couldn't light the menorah in the daily service. They decreed against mitzvah observance, so you couldn't keep Shabbos, so you couldn't have a bris milah. A lot of mitzvahs the rabbis teach us were prohibited by the Greeks. Because since our underlying spiritual cause, which brought upon this tragedy, was that we became lax and lazy mitzvah observance, therefore the Greeks came in and God allowed them to decree and prohibit mitzvah observance. So what happened? In the story, what happened is that the Chashmonaim family, as we call the Maccabees, they rose up and they sacrificed their own lives. They stood up to defend mitzvah observance. That's why they fought. They weren't trying to fight for autonomy. They weren't fighting for physical freedom. They wanted to have spiritual freedom. They wanted the Jews not to assimilate. They wanted us to keep the Torah and keep mitzvahs. And therefore, they fought. They fought the battle. Many of them were killed in the battle. But it was kind of the opposite of the cause. The cause was we became lazy in observing the Torah. We became lax in observing mitzvahs. So we had to put our lives on the line to observe mitzvahs. And that's what happened in the struggle of Hanukkah. The salvation came through Kohanim. The Chashmonaim family, the Maccabees, were Kohanim, as we say in the prayers. And they're the ones who perform the service in the temple. Because since the whole decree was because we became lax in the service of God, those Jews who are known to be servants of God, they were the ones who fought the battle. The miracle happened through the candles in the temple, and of the menorah, the lights of the menorah. And that's because the miracle happened through divine service, through temple service. Because since we became lax in temple service, God provided a miracle in the temple service. And the rabbis established a holiday. You know, as much as we eat on Hanukkah, there is not a mitzvah to eat on Hanukkah. You know, every single Jewish holiday, we have a mitzvah to eat, besides Hanukkah. Now, there's a custom. We eat lots of food on Hanukkah. We have our latkes, and we have our donuts, and we have our chocolate gelt, and everything else we eat on Hanukkah. But there is no mitzvah to have a festive meal on Hanukkah. There is no mitzvah to eat anything on Hanukkah. As opposed to other holidays where you have a mitzvah to have a festive meal. And that's because on Hanukkah, the main constitution of the holiday is for praise of God, show gratitude towards God. It's a service of the heart, not a service of the body. Purim is the day we're celebrating the service of the body. We have a festive meal and we dance and sing. And Hanukkah's day we're celebrating the Jewish heart and the Jewish soul, because it's the day where we fought to observe mitzvot and to learn Torah. Therefore, on Hanukkah, our focus is showing gratitude through prayer and through Torah study and spiritual ways. Yeah.
You say hello.
Yeah, you say hello on Hanukkah. You say hello. That's, yeah. How can the rabbis...
Well, I mean, I've been fighting this challenge for something else that's going on.
Yeah.
About doing something that's not an obligation, but would otherwise be a commandment for something else.
Right.
So my question is, Hallel is a commandment, but Hanukkah is rabbinic. So what right, under what guidance...
That's a very good question. Actually, the Gemara itself asked that question about lighting Hanukkah candles. Hanukkah candles themselves are rabbinic. When we light the Hanukkah candles, we say, Asher Kisham Mitzvah V'Tzivana, that God sanctified us with His commandments and commanded us to light the Hanukkah candles. Now, you'd say, well, God didn't do it, the rabbis did it. And this is a question that the Talmud itself asks. It's rabbinic, it's not from God, so how can we say those words? And the answer is that the Torah itself gave the authority to the rabbis to institute new laws. It says, you shall not veer off from the words they tell you, either left and right. It says you should ask your elders and listen to what they say. The Torah itself recognizes the authority of the rabbis. Therefore, we can even say when we do a rabbinic mitzvah, we can actually say that God commanded us to do this. God said you listen to the rabbis. That's where it comes from. Same thing with Hallel, and same thing with reading the Megillah and Purim, and same thing with many rabbinic mitzvahs. There are seven official rabbinic mitzvahs that we do. There's 613 Torah mitzvahs and 7 rabbinic mitzvahs. So, but all on all those 7, you can make a bracha that God commanded us to perform this mitzvah, despite the fact that it's rabbinic, because God said you have to listen to the rabbis. So
the seven laws,
this is different. The 7 Noahide laws are our Torah obligations. Shabbos candles, washing hands for bread, making an Eruv, Hanukkah, Purim, Hallel, and I'm short one. There's one more. I can't remember offhand the 7th one. But those are the Shabbos candles, washing hands, Hanukkah, Purim, Hallel, Eruv. I can't remember the 7th one, but those are. That's not. Yeah, that's kind of that's included in that.
What about the other part of the Torah that says you shall not add to these commandments, or you shall not subtract
them? No, they're not. This is a good question, but I don't want to get off topic. This is getting off topic here. Right?
Odu.
Yeah. That's not part. That's not a mitzvah. Not a mitzvah. Okay, let's get back on topic. So the Bach tells us that the entire tragedy, the challenge of Chanukah, had happened due to the fact that we became lax in the service of God. Therefore, we had to sacrifice our lives and put our lives in the line to serve God and to do His commandments and to study His Torah. The miracle happened within divine service in the temple, the miracle with the menorah, and the rabbis established a holiday to praise God and to say Hallel and to pray and to strengthen ourselves in the midst of observance, but not a holiday to celebrate physically. So if you look at Chanukah in this light, it gives us a new message of Chanukah. Because Chanukah happened at a time where there was a lapse in the service of God. There was assimilation, as we pointed out. There was a lot of assimilation. But even the Jews who weren't assimilated, they weren't quite, you know, as motivated, as enthusiastic about their divine service. They became dispassionate, disinterested, you know, kind of cold in the service of God. It became kind of numb, a routine. Even those who did the actions, you know, their hearts were not connected. And that's what the Bach is telling us. Mitzvah performance became very dry. There wasn't a connection felt. People were, you know, kind of asleep, you know, in their service of God. The miracle of Chanukah came to inject a passion and an enthusiasm, exuberance in our service of God, an excitement into our actions. And so you find many examples of this as well. I want to start just showing this picture of how Chanukah represents enthusiasm in the service of God. But looking at the ancestor of Greece, you know, Greece in the Torah referred to as Yavan. Yavan is the nation of Greece. And Yavan was actually a son of Noah. Noah had a son, Yefes, who had a son, Yavan. Right? He was Noah's grandson, Yavan. Now, he was the ancestor of Greece, of the Greek people. So the famous story of Yefes, of Yavan's father, happened in the end of Parshas Noah. After he leaves the ark. So we have this interesting story where he gets drunk in his tent, and he becomes unclothed, he exposes himself, and his sons notice. So his sons, Shem and Yefes, they come in to cover their father, so he wouldn't be ashamed, so he wouldn't be subject to such embarrassment. But when the Torah says they came in to cover their father, what does it say? It uses a very funny term, because it's talking about two people. In Hebrew, if two people were to take a cloth, it should say vayikhu in plural. But yet, it says vayikach, it says he took. It says vayikach shem vayefes asimla, that he, Shem and Yefes, took the shirt, the dress. Now it should have said vayikhu, they took. Why does it say he took? It's talking about two people. The grammar is wrong. So Rashi points out, in Midrash, it says that actually, even though Yefes was involved in covering his father, Shem was the one who took the initiative. And he was nis'amitz mitzvah yoser, Rashi says. He's somebody who was more, had more enthusiasm, he was stronger in his mitzvah performance than Yefes, in covering his father. So in some way, Yefes was considered kind of lax in the mitzvah, and Shem was somebody who was more diligent in the mitzvah. That's what Rashi points out. So the pasuk, the Torah gives us, when it tries to tell you who are the people who covered up their father, it actually emphasizes Shem more than Yefes. Even though they both performed this act of kindness and covered their father, the Torah emphasizes that Shem was the one who had the motivation, took the initiative, and Yefes kind of followed along. So the grandfather priest of Yavlon, is somebody who has blamed the Torah for being not so enthusiastic about doing the right thing, but doing a mitzvah. His mitzvah to cover their father, save him from embarrassment. He was not so into it. He did it, he went along, but he was not the one who had the enthusiasm and the diligence and the initiative. It was Shem who had it. So when the Jewish people became lax in their mitzvah observance, that's when Yavlon can come along, and they can come and show us that, you know, just like our ancestor was someone who was lax in mitzvah observance, we're doing the same thing right now. Now we have power over you. Why is it that the Jewish people are able to have power over Greece? It's because we are excitedly, enthusiastically performing the mitzvot and studying Torah. So now we have a merit more so than the children of Yefes do. Because our ancestor, Shem, he was enthusiastic about performing a mitzvah. Yefes, the ancestor of Greece, was not so enthusiastic. But when we lose our enthusiasm, now we're on the same level anymore. We don't have any extra merits over Greece. So that's one place where you see that the very origins of the Greek nation, they began in somebody who was not enthusiastic about performing a mitzvah. And the Jews were enthusiastic at that point. We lost our enthusiasm, in comes Greece to attack. And that's one time we see this concept in the origins of Greece. Another point that we see is that on Hanukkah, the daily Torah reading on Hanukkah, we read of the gifts that the princes of all the tribes brought to the dedication of the Mishkan in the desert. Now, these gifts that they brought different offerings to offer to the temple, to the Mishkan, each day as they're dedicating the Mishkan. Now, the rabbis point out, let me find the right verse here, the rabbis point out in Parshas Vayakel, it says that when they were building the Mishkan, the Nesiim were the last ones to bring gifts, when actually building it. Every single Jew donated different items to build the Mishkan. He brought in their gold and their silver, and he brought in cloth, all sorts of things. And the princes of the tribes, they came in at the very end, and they donated certain stones, which were used for some of the garments of the Kohanim. But when it says they brought in these stones, it says HaNesiim, which is what we call the princes of the tribes in Hebrew, but it writes the word missing the letter Yud, missing two Yuds actually. And why are those letters missing? So Rashi tells us that how come when the word Nesiim is written in the Torah, we leave out the letter Yud? And Rashi says because they had waited till the very end to bring in their gifts. They said, well, let's just watch and see what happens. And we'll fill in the gaps. You know, at the end, we'll see what's left and we'll fill in the gaps. Now, they're actually accused of being a little bit lazy about donating. They should have taken the initiative. They're the princes. They should have been the first ones there with the best gifts possible. They said, no, we'll wait and see what happens. You know, we'll cover the gaps once everything's over. Similar to Ephesus in a certain sense. They were being lax. You know, they're being lax about performing a mitzvah. So what happened? They waited and they waited and they waited and they waited. And there wasn't much to fill because the Jews were so enthusiastic about donating to the Mishkan. Almost everything else is already donated. All that's left was a few stones to donate. They're probably expensive stones, I guess. But I assume the princes were wealthy people who could have donated anything. So at the end, there was already enough to build the Mishkan. They had very little left to donate. And they felt ashamed, and they're blamed for being lazy, you know, for being a little bit lax, not having the initiative, the motivation, enthusiasm to perform the mitzvah. So later on, when it came to the dedication of the Mishkan, they were the first ones to come and bring in gifts and offerings, because they had to make up for their loss. So when the Mishkan was dedicated, the 12 princes of the tribes, they were the first ones to come in with gifts, because they had to make up for the fact that they were lazy and lax, and they had to be enthusiastic and take initiative in performing a mitzvah. So what we read in the Torah on Hanukkah every single day are these gifts is about the gifts of these princes, and this is when they're actually bringing the gifts in for the dedication, which is when they're trying to show their enthusiasm, that we're going to take the initiative, we're motivated, we're excited, we're going to be the first ones there with our gifts. Now they're there to make up for their previous shortcomings, but it's the same concept. The Hanukkah is a time where we try to focus on the fact that Jews had lost their excitement, enthusiasm for mitzvos. And Hanukkah is supposed to teach us to be enthusiastic and passionate about performing a mitzvah. So our daily Torah reading of Hanukkah is showing the enthusiasm of the Nesiim, of the princes, in bringing in their gifts to the Mishkan as it was dedicated. There's another, I'll call it, you know, a little more obscure reference to this concept, but I think it's an interesting reference. When the Talmud describes how long are we supposed to have our Hanukkah candles lit, and what's the waste time for lighting Hanukkah candles, so it describes that, you know, the goal of Hanukkah candles is to publicize it to people out in the streets. So in their days especially, I mean, it was very dark, there weren't street lights. and people weren't on the streets very late. Because once it got pitch black outside, you'd be at home. It wasn't very easy to walk around holding a candle trying to find your way. So the Gemara tells us that how late should you have a kind of candles lit? It says until the feet of this nation called the Tarmudai, the, I guess, Tarmudians, were no longer in the marketplace. Now, who are these people, Tarmudai? So Rashi explains to us that these were a nation of merchants who used to sell, you know, small twigs, kindling for fires. And what happened is that you'd go home at night, and you go to light your fire in your house, and you'd see you don't have enough wood. So they'd be out there late in the marketplace. You'd go out for a late night shopping trip to get extra wood to bring home. So they were the last ones daily in the marketplace in any established way, because they were there to sell the wood for people who went home and didn't have any wood. Now, the description of these people is interesting. I mean, it happens to be this is what they did, these people, this nation called the Tarmudai, but you know, that's how the Gemara describes how long you should have your candles lit. You should have them lit until the Tarmudai are no longer in the marketplace, because they're going to be the last ones out there. They'll see your candles, and once they go home, no one's out there anymore to see your candles. But there is a reference made. This word Tarmudai, Tarmudians, is the same letters, just about, in the similar numerical value as Tardema, which means a slumber, being asleep. And on some level, there's a reference here that you should light your Hanukkah candles until those people who are slumbering or sleeping are no longer out there, meaning that we have to be woken up. Hanukkah candles are supposed to take us from our spiritual slumber and wake us up, give us some enthusiasm. We talk about somebody who's alert and focused, somebody who's kind of sleeping and dozing off in their observance of Torah mitzvahs. So this nation, Tarmudai, which is similar to the word Tardema, is a reference to the fact that we have to light our Hanukkah candles so that we can eliminate any sleepiness from our service of God. The mitzvah of Hanukkah, lighting Hanukkah candles, is in the dark of the night, in the cold of the winter. We know that coldness and darkness usually represent a form of detachment or lack of passion. You know, warmth and light, that represents passion in our minds. And Hanukkah is supposed to kind of ignite us, give us the passion and excitement in our service of God, and eliminate the rote and the, you know, the routine and the lack of passion in the service of God. One other reference we have to this, there's a lot of references to this, another reference you have is that the miracle happened through Kohanim. Now the Kohanim are known to be people who have a lot of enthusiasm in the service of God. The Talmud says over and over again, Kohanim's rizim heim. The Kohanim are known to be zariz, known to be enthusiastic and diligent. And Kohanim were a tribe, and they were a family that had a mark of diligence upon them. So they are our models in Hanukkah, because the heroic family of Hanukkah were Kohanim. And they're showing us about diligence in the service of God. The Haftorah we read last week on Shabbos, of Shabbos Hanukkah, the Haftorah is a passage from the book of Zechariah. And the book of Zechariah, in that passage, it begins that he was sleeping. The prophet Zechariah was sleeping. And it says that an angel came to him and woke him up. It woke him up. And this is the Haftorah read every single Hanukkah. It opens up that he was sleeping and the angel woke him up. And again, it seems to be another reference that Hanukkah is about waking us up out of a spiritual slumber. That, you know, we don't have the passion or the excitement and enthusiasm in our service to God. And Hanukkah is supposed to come and shake us a little bit and say, you should wake up, you should ignite a spark, you should be excited. Now the question is, these are a lot of references to the fact that Hanukkah should excite us in service of God. We should bring enthusiasm and excitement and, you know, and joy in serving God. Now how does this idea of the idea of the battle between the Jews and Greece represent this battle? Now we discussed last week how Greece represents the concept of science, of nature, the wisdom of our world. And the battle of the Jewish people versus Greece was a battle of Torah wisdom, of the wisdom of God versus the wisdom of our world. That was the battle, and how those two things are supposed to interact. That's the battle of Hanukkah. But why is it that Greece represents to us a dispassion in the service of God? Why does it represent being kind of cooled off and numb and routine in the service of God? And I think it's very, very simple. It's because we talk a lot about people who are kind of, you know, very technical or scientific, academic type people. Our information which is very academic or scientific is not always very passionate. It's very hard to get excited about it. You might think it's interesting. You might feel that it's important. You might have a lot of usage for it. But to say that I have a passion, that I'm enthusiastic about something which is very academic, is very hard. Now, there are people who can get very excited about math or about science. That's true. But there's a reason we say this is a very technical thing, and therefore it's going to be boring to you. That's usually what we say. Things that are technical are not exciting. They might be interesting and useful, but they're usually not exciting. What? If we treat the Torah as something which is just information, as academic, as intellectual, we lose the passion in the Torah study, so we lose our enthusiasm for it. We might say this is important information, there's a lot of lessons in the Torah, God told us a lot of important things, but if it's just kind of intellectual fodder, it's scholarly, it's academic, we don't let the heart of Torah and the soul of Torah impact us. So then it's very on par with science or math. These are true facts, they're true equations, and it's very hard to be enthusiastic with something which is just information. However, when Torah becomes something of a passion, then not only is information which is intellectual, it's also something which excites you and has a heart and soul to it, that's when our mitzvah observance and our Torah study becomes exciting and passionate. And this very much relates to a different comment of the same commentary of the Bach on a different discussion. There's a very interesting passage in the Gemara. The Gemara says, it's basing itself on a quote in the book of the prophets. I think it's the book of Yecheskel. It says, I forgot what book it's in, but it's a passage in the prophets. And it says, why is it the land was destroyed? Why are we thrown into exile? So many answers are given to that question. But one answer given was because the Gemara says, we didn't make the blessing on the Torah. We didn't make the bracha on the Torah. Now, it's funny, because it implies that they were studying Torah and observing the Torah, but they didn't make the blessing on the Torah. And every morning, there's a mitzvah to make a blessing on Torah study. It's part of the daily prayers. And the Gemara says, because we didn't make that blessing, therefore, we were thrown out of the land. So many people ask the question, you're supposed to make the blessing, we didn't do it, but does that really warrant us being thrown out of our land? Is it such a severe crime? Even if we were doing everything else right, we forgot that one blessing, and that's it. We can't be in the land of Israel anymore. It's a very strange thing. So there's a famous comment of the Bach, the same commentary we quoted before, and he says that, what does it represent that we didn't make the blessing of the Torah? It says that we saw Torah as something which was just information. What we can do, what we can't do, what's right, what's wrong. And it's true, the Torah is that. The Torah is very much a lot of information. What's right, what's wrong, what's okay, what's not okay, what's permissible, what's a mitzvah, what's prohibited. But he says that there's a whole different element to Torah, which if you don't make the blessing of the Torah, you're missing. Because the blessing of the Torah represents that you're using Torah not just as information, not just as a textbook. We're using Torah to be something which connects you to God. And he says that when they study Torah, they're studying Torah just to tell them how to act in life, or for their own pleasure, or to help them in business, or in order to become arrogant through their knowledge. But they did not study the Torah in order to cling to the holiness of the Torah, cling to God and spirituality and the soul of the Torah to bring down God's presence into our world. There's an element of Torah which is information, but there's another element of Torah which is that you're involving yourself in something which is divine, which is powerful, which is spiritual, which is empowering, which is inspiring. And if you study Torah with the idea that you want to bind yourself with the creator of the world and the holiness of the Torah, the sanctity of the Torah, to bring down God into this world, that's always the goal. That's the goal of Torah studies, not just the information which is there. But somebody who studies Torah just for the information, but doesn't use it at all to connect spiritually, that person is lacking to the extent that God says you cannot remain in the land of Israel if you study Torah in that manner. And that's what the Bach explains. He says that when you go to open up a book of Torah and study, and you make the blessing beforehand, what you're doing is you are recognizing that God gave us the Torah in order so that we can cling to its sanctity, and cling to Him, cling to the Shekhinah, cling to the Divine Presence. But if you study Torah merely as information, as something which is academic or scholarly, but not as something which is spiritual and passionate, then you've missed out. So this is the same concept that the Torah, we have to always have a balance. You know, Torah is something which is very intellectual. It's very challenging, it's very scholarly, very academic, and there's a lot of very important information in the Torah, and every Jew is encouraged to understand the Torah to the best of their ability intellectually, and make it a real intellectual pursuit. When you're studying Torah, you don't say, this is just spiritual and ignore it. You say, I need to figure it out. I know what it means. The Torah is built on, the Talmud is built on questions and answers and refutations and proofs and logic. It's a very intellectual pursuit. It really is. But yet, if you leave it at that, and you leave it just like I study math or I study physics, I also study the Torah, so then you've lost out on the entire spiritual element of the Torah. And then if you lose out on the holiness, on the sanctity, on the passion, on the soul, and the heart of the Torah itself. And then that doesn't lead to enthusiasm in mitzvos, that leads to just an intellect. That's all it leads to. So if the focus of Greece was on the intellect, and the focus of Greek wisdom and culture was on the intellect, we have to understand the Torah is something that goes far beyond the intellect. Now, the balance we have to make is a balance of, I'm as honest as I can intellectually when I study the Torah, and I do my best to use logic and all sorts of proofs and any intellectual means I have to understand things to its best. However, I understand that as I study Torah, I'm connecting with the divine, I'm connecting with God. I'm bringing down sanctity to our world, I'm sanctifying myself, I'm connecting with something which is far beyond our world. You know, it's an amazing thing. The Talmud says that, and it was really based, you know, there's written verses in Psalms about this, or even go back to Psalms. King David says, Zviros hayulichu kecha, that your laws are songs to me. And if you look at the commentaries on the Psalms, it says that the King David, who wrote the Psalms, when he studied Torah, it was with the great joy of his heart. It was like a song to him, it was with a passion, it was with an excitement, with emotion. The Gemara tells us that you're supposed to study with a song. You know, it says that if you read the Torah without the chant, you know, we always chant the Torah in shul. Or if you are to study a Mishnah, and you don't sing the Mishnah. So it's as if you're telling God that, you know, what you gave me is not so special. And we're supposed to, when we study, and if you walk into a yeshiva, or into a base medrash, you watch people studying, there's a song, there's a chant. Everyone's singing, you know. It's an amazing thing. If you walk into, you know, a college study hall or library, it's either quiet, even if it's loud, nobody's singing the textbook. No one sings the physics book, you know? You ever seen that before, singing a physics book?
You have.
Oh, sure, you know? You don't have some other calculus book, you know, singing out the formulas. You don't have that. You know, on Simchas Torah, we dance with the Torah. I mean, I've never seen anybody dance with a biology book. You know, you don't see it. So on the one hand, it's a very intellectual type of study, and something which we have to be very honest intellectually with. We have to make sure we keep the passion and excitement involved. And that's what Torah study leads us. You should study the Torah with a song, because there's an emotion along with the intellect. Yeah.
What were you talking about again, bringing the song and passion? Could we connect that to the Hasidic movement in Europe where they were trying?
Oh, absolutely. So this actually is one of the major debates which created the Hasidic movement. Because the Hasidim felt that the Jews at the time were just too dry and unemotional. They're very intellectual. They studied the Torah in depth. They knew the Talmud backwards and forwards, but there was no soul and there's no passion. The Hasidic movement came to introduce more soul and passion and song and warmth to Judaism. Now, the other side, you know, the Misnagdim, they came up and opposed that, and they tried to introduce in their own way some more passion. But this was really the debate which occurred, because when Torah became too intellectual and academic and lost out on its emotion and passion, it did very much create a problem. Because we need to have both in the Torah study. You can't let it be just a dry academic study. It has to be something which is very emotional. But yet, you have to make sure that you still remain with the true intellect and study it with proper logic and proper proof and proper thought, because or else you're not giving it its due value. The Torah is a very advanced study. You know, the Torah can be studied at very high levels, and it's something which is could be just as challenging or more challenging than picking up a high-level graduate biology textbook. You know, it can go be the same way if you stay sure on the right level. But this is one of the big struggles of Hanukkah, was that the Jews became dispassionate in the service of God, and we had to then show that we were going to reintroduce the passion to Torah study and to mitzvah observance. And therefore, when we light the menorah on Hanukkah, the menorah represents to us, we mentioned last week, the menorah represents to us wisdom. We mentioned that last week. But the menorah includes a fire. And fire in our minds is always, there's a spark, there's excitement, there's passion. Talk about somebody who's ignited. That's that being passionate. So it's always the same terminology in English too. This person is on fire. There's a warmth to this person. You feel the emotions. You feel the compassion. And the menorah is supposed to show us and teach us the idea of enthusiasm in the service of God. And that's why the miracle happens in the temple with in divine service, because God was showing us that the miracle of Hanukkah is supposed to lead us to more passion in our service of God. That's why it was the Kohanim, who are known to be passionate people. And this was the struggle of Hanukkah, and so therefore the teshuva that we did on Hanukkah, the way that we rectified our problem, was through reintroducing an excitement and joy and passion in our service of God. Now every year, when a holiday comes around, that means that God is reinserting into the world the same spiritual elements that were there at the time of the miracle. Because on Hanukkah, we have the ability to get ourselves excited, more so the rest of the year. On Hanukkah, if we make the steps, make the strides to become more passionate, excited in the service of God, God gives us an extra special, you know, helping of divine assistance in doing that. And that's part of the opportunity about every single Yom Tov. Especially in Hanukkah, you have the opportunity in terms of passion and excitement in serving God. So this is an element of Hanukkah I think a lot of us don't think about and miss. But in our 2 days left of Hanukkah, we have an opportunity to try to introduce the enthusiasm and passion and light those sparks which are there. The idea of oil's potential. You have to light it on fire and then you have a beautiful flame. So we all have the potential to have that excitement and that warmth. And if we just let that spark of Hanukkah ignite us, we can become very passionate and more excited in our service of God. I want to add in just one more point in our final few minutes here, which is that the Rambam, Maimonides, he describes Hanukkah in a very unique way. Because the Rambam is somebody who actually is very much pinned down as being very, very dry and intellectual. Which the truth is, that if you read his works, it's not always true, because he's very passionate about some things if you read through the Rambam's writings. He's somebody who we do pin down as more of an intellectual, more of a, people call him a realist, or somebody who's just, you know, you picture the Rambam as this big brain sitting there just churning out, you know, different philosophies and Jewish law and everything else. But when the Rambam describes Hanukkah, he actually gives it a unique adjective, which he doesn't use to describe any other mitzvah. He says that Hanukkah is chaviva hi anmod. Hanukkah is a very dear mitzvah to us. It's a very dear mitzvah. And the Rambam, especially in his work, the Mishnah Torah, rarely adds in extra adjectives just to make things seem more poetic and flowery. But of all mitzvahs out there, the Rambam describes Hanukkah as chaviv, I mean very dear, very precious. And many commentators try to discuss what is it about Hanukkah which is just so dear and precious to us. What makes it so precious? One approach I found in a book by Rabbi Moshe Wolfson, Honemusi Techa, he writes that, we all know this is true, that those things which we work the hardest towards and we sacrifice the most for are always the most precious to us. Anybody who has ever had to do anything, took a lot of effort, a lot of energy, a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of self-sacrifice, so that accomplishment is a very precious thing in our minds, in our lives, because we work so hard at it. So Hanukkah is, every other holiday is very different than Hanukkah. Every other holiday was where we got ourselves into trouble, in some way or another, and God came and saved us. On Hanukkah we were in trouble, and God did not yet come to save us. On Hanukkah we picked up our weapons and we started fighting, with a lot of self-sacrifice, with a lot of risk involved. And people died, and it was a very difficult situation, a very difficult battle. Only later on did we see the divine assistance. God came in, helped us win the war. God provided for us the miracle in the temple of the menorah burning. But it was only after we showed our own dedication and self-sacrifice. So based on that, Hanukkah is a time where because we had to sacrifice our own lives and our own selves for the miracle, we had to put forth our own efforts. We had to fight our own battle. So that became so precious to us because we had to sacrifice ourselves for Hanukkah. When you think about the miracles of Pesach, so we were slaves, but God just came in and saved us. You think about the miracles of Purim, so there was a decree of annihilation. We repented, but we didn't fight a battle, and God came in and saved us. On Hanukkah, we fought the battle, and without any sign from God, we picked our weapons, and those signs from God, He was going to help us. And we fought, and we fought, and we fought, and God came in, and then God performed a miracle. So Hanukkah is a time we look at as a time when we call Mesiras Nefesh, of self-sacrifice. And Hanukkah is so dear because we sacrificed ourselves for Hanukkah, so Hanukkah is very precious to us. And I think we kind of sense that Hanukkah is a very special time for every single Jew who feels something very special about Hanukkah. Now, the idea of self-sacrifice is something which, on the one hand, we hope we don't have to deal with true self-sacrifice, meaning to give our lives for God, we hope we never have to deal with the situation. And that's true martyrdom is the ultimate Mesiras Nefesh, is the ultimate sacrifice for God, sacrifice our lives. However, there's other ways to sacrifice ourselves for God as well, which don't mean sacrificing our lives. I grew up in Atlanta. Rabbi Lon Feldman in Atlanta had a term for this. He called it, there's a martyrdom moment. You can be a martyr, you can martyrdom moment. And a martyrdom moment means that sometimes we have to give up something of ourselves for God, whether it be money, whether it be time, whether it be energy, whether it be holding back on a juicy piece of Lashon Hara, whether it be not eating a food that's questionably kosher, whether it be not doing something which is questionable, if you could do it on Shabbos or not, there's certain things which we perform and are difficult for us not to do. we hold ourselves back. We're sacrificing of ourselves for God. So we sacrificed our lives, we sacrificed our own pleasure, we sacrificed our time, we sacrificed our emotions, we sacrificed a lot for God. And since Hanukkah is the time, it's a holiday which was formed through self-sacrifice, it's a time of year where we can actually excel in our own self-sacrifice for God. We can have these martyrdom moments. We can say, I'm so, you know, I'm talking to a friend, and I really want to share this room or this piece of Lashon Hara. And it's, you know, I really want to get it out, but I'm just going to hold back. I'm going to sacrifice my desires because it's the wrong thing to do. You know, I'm so hungry. This food in front of me is questionable if it's kosher or not. So, you know, I've seen this hechsher before, but I'm not really sure. And, you know, but I'm really hungry. It looks really good. You say, I'm hungry, but I'm going to hold back. You know, there's a lot of situations where we have to hold back even though we really want to do it. And that's a form of self-sacrifice. That's where we're sacrificing of ourselves for God. So I'm in a terrible mood. I don't want to talk to anybody, but I'm going to smile at somebody. I'm going to sacrifice my own personal desire so I can share a smile, share a kind word, because I want to do that for God. It's a mitzvah to do that. So Hanukkah is a time which we very much can focus on what we would call Mesiras Nefesh, on this idea of martyrdom moments, of self-sacrifice. And again, we have the divine assistance during this time of year, more so than other times of year, that we can actually excel in these areas. And we'll see that if we make attempts to sacrifice ourselves for God, we will find a lot of success and divine assistance in those attempts. So I guess in summary, our two major ideas of Hanukkah we brought up today are the idea of introducing more passion and enthusiasm in the performance of mitzvos in our study of Torah. And secondly is the idea of sacrificing of ourselves, of our energy, of our time, of our desires, of our emotions, on behalf of God. And that's an element of what the Maccabees did, that they sacrificed their lives. And we hope we never have to come to that. We can sacrifice other things in order to serve God and serve God in a better way.
It's a very proactive festival, and a festival of action.
Yes, definitely a festival of action.
Question.
Yeah.
The entire thank you.